be good for us to think what it will be like to see Christ face to face one day. Imagine that, to see him face to face. What will it be? Tonight I want us to take our Bibles and go to Numbers chapter 23. Numbers chapter 23. In these chapters, Numbers 22 to 24, we read the story of a man by the name of Balak, king of Moab, and Balaam, a prophet somewhere in Mesopotamia from a distance away. King Balak saw the children of Israel coming. And he said, man, we're in trouble. These people, they're everywhere. I've heard about what they're doing. And so King Balak is concerned. Now, I say that to introduce what I'm talking about tonight this way. Israel had a testimony. And was Israel perfect? The children of Israel were belligerent, rebellious, and yet they were God's people. Everybody has a testimony, a reputation, what people know about you. Your reputation is what people know about you. Your character is really who you are. And sometimes you may be able to impress people with your reputation and cover up your real character. But your testimony, how you conduct yourself in this world, is very important. But to a lot of Christians, it's becoming less and less important because Christians are acting more and more like the world, looking like the world. It's hard to differentiate Christians from the world. I am not on Facebook, but I do go on my wife's Facebook sometimes to see what's happening. She always says, let me put your name in. I said, I don't want people contacting me. I don't have time for that. But I do go to Facebook from time to time. How can I say this? But I am so disappointed in people. People I thought had standards. People I thought were concerned about their testimony. And yet you can learn about people by their likes. You can learn about people by things that they post. Oh, you've got to watch this. By statements they make. Pictures that they post. That's just on Facebook. That's not even talking about somebody's life and the language that they use. The dress. The music. You know those things that fundamental pastors are always talking about. People get sick and tired of hearing. And the reason they get sick and tired of hearing is because it's a continual problem, so it needs to be continually addressed by those who are courageous enough to do so, so that people get tired of it. We've been going through the book of Exodus, and we saw in Exodus chapter 19 how that God wanted his people to be a peculiar people. Remember that? On display for the world to see God's grace. Did Israel deserve to be rescued from Egypt? Was there anything that Israel had done that deserved, that where God said, oh man, you deserve to come out of Israel or out of Egypt? No. Therefore, it was clearly God's grace. Undeserved favor to bring them out of Egypt. Just like, did you deserve to be saved? No. Simply God's grace. Undeserved favor. Egypt saw the grace of God when he brought his people out of their land. So he brings them to the base of Mount Sinai there in Exodus chapter 19, and there God gives them his law, his statutes, his judgments. Listen, so that the world, the nations, would observe why Israel is so great. So you've got your thumb, perhaps, or your fingers there in Numbers chapter 23. Go to Deuteronomy chapter 4. Note what God says to the children of Israel. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 5, 6, 7, and 8. This is at the end of their wilderness wanderings, at the end of the 40 years in the wilderness. Moses is about to die. Deuteronomy is basically Moses adjuring the children of Israel, I'm about to go. Now here's some things I want to leave with you. Notice what he says in verse 5 of Deuteronomy chapter 4. Behold, I have taught you statutes and judgments, even as the Lord my God commanded me, that ye should do so in the land whither ye go to possess it. Keep therefore and do them. Listen, watch this. For this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations, which shall hear all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what nation is there so great who hath God so nigh unto them as the Lord our God is in all things that we call upon him for? And what nation is there so great that hath statutes and judgments, so righteous as all this law which I set before you this day? Do you see that Israel is on display for the nations? God is wanting his people to be an exhibit of his grace. He wants the nations to see what happens when a people keeps his law, his statutes, and his judgments, and how that makes them great. What used to make the United States of America a great nation was basically a nation that respected God's word. And you see this nation decline in keeping with how we less and less heed the word of God. The world observed Israel. And the world, these other nations, viewed Israel as a threat to them. Hey, does anybody view you as a threat to them? Is the world viewing Christians as a threat to them today? If you don't think so, you have not been looking. You have not been watching the news. Maybe that's a good thing. But they view you as a threat to them if you are a peculiar people. If you are seeking to be a peculiar group of people to God. If you are peculiar, you're not a threat to them otherwise. In the same way, Balak, king of Moab, viewed Israel. Back to Numbers chapter 22. And I'm going to read the first four verses. Now, you've got to understand right up from the front, because sometimes it's easy to get them confused, because you've got Balak and Balaam. Balak is king of Moab. Balaam is a false prophet called upon by Balak to come and curse Israel. So Numbers chapter 22 verses 1 through 4. And the children of Israel set forward and pitched in the plains of Moab on this side Jordan by Jericho. And Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites, and Moab was sore afraid of the people because they were many. And Moab was distressed because of the children of Israel. And Moab said unto the elders of Midian, now shall this company lick up all that are round about us, as the ox licketh up the grass of the field. And Balak, the son of Zippor, was king of the Moabites at that time. So here's this king. He sees Israel. They're a threat to him. So what does he do? He hires somebody. Verse 5, he sent messengers therefore unto Balaam, the son of Beor, to Pethor, which is by the river of the land of the children of his people, to call him, saying, by the way, that river is probably the river Euphrates. He's coming a long way. He sends all the way to him, saying, behold, there is a people come up out of Egypt. Behold, they cover the face of the earth, and they abide over against me. Come now, therefore, I pray thee, curse me this people, for they are too mighty for me. Peradventure I shall prevail that we may smite them, and that I may drive them out of the land. For I wot that he whom thou blessest is blessed, and he whom thou cursest is cursed. Remember we were talking about flattery this morning? Balak is flattering Balaam. hey, whoever you curse, they're cursed. Whoever you bless, they're blessed. Please come curse this people for me. Now, you've got to understand Balaam. Balaam, question. Balaam, good man, bad man? But he spoke what God said. But I agree with you. I heard all the bads. Definitely bad. And we're going to see that tonight here right up front. Although he communicates God's word to Balak, he was not a man of God. Because what he communicated, he did not do it willingly. You see, God can use anything to communicate. Jesus said he could have these stones cry out. Just because somebody may communicate God's word doesn't mean that that particular man is a man of God. God used King Cyrus to accomplish his will in the world in his day. But Cyrus? God used Nebuchadnezzar. God used Alexander the Great. Go through history and see how God used unbelieving men. Some to even speak his word. God used King Saul. God used even one of his disciples, Jesus' disciples, Judas Iscariot, an unsaved man. Balaam is repeatedly mentioned by name here in Numbers chapter 20, chapters 22 all the way through chapter 24. This is the account of how God used him. And you read this and you would almost respect and appreciate this man if it weren't for the later mentions about him that clarify his real methods and motives. So here you see him in Numbers 22 to 24, but I want us to go to Numbers 31, verse 8. And for some reason, I don't have it up on the screen. I just now noticed that. There we go. Numbers 22 to 24. Now I want you to look at Numbers 31, verse 8. And they slew the kings of Midian beside the rest of them that were slain, namely Evi, Rechem, Zur, Hur, and Reba, five kings of Midian. Balaam also, the son of Beor, they slew with the sword. Go to verse 16. Behold, these caused the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to commit trespass against the Lord in the matter of Peor, and there was a plague among the congregation of the Lord. You can see here how that Balaam was a man who counseled through others to influence Israel to sin. You'll see the same thing in Joshua chapter 13, verse 22. We're not going to turn there, but I'm putting up on the screen all the references in the Bible to this man, Balaam. You get to Deuteronomy chapter 23, verses 4 to 5. And there you see that what Balaam did, he did unwillingly. And notice what it says there, the Lord would not hearken unto Balaam. Balaam continually asked God, let me curse these people. God says, I'm not going to let you curse them. God would not hearken unto Balaam. The same thing is mentioned in Joshua 24, 9 and 10. He's again mentioned in Nehemiah 13, 2. Again, in Micah chapter 6 and verse 5. That's the Old Testament mentions of this man, Balaam. Then you get to the New Testament. And this man in the Old Testament, who lived in Moses' time, is mentioned three times in the New Testament. All dealing with false prophets. And it says this in 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 15 and 16. It talks about the way of Balaam. Let's just go to 2 Peter chapter 2. Let's look at these three New Testament mentions of this man. 2 Peter chapter 2, verses 15 and 16. Verse 14 says that these false prophets have eyes full of adultery. They cannot cease from sin. They beguile unstable souls. And heart they have exercised with covetous practices, cursed children, which have forsaken the right way and are gone astray, following the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness, but was rebuked for his iniquity. The dumb ass, speaking with man's voice, forbade the madness of the prophet. This is one of the more humorous accounts in the Bible, where Balaam's riding his ass. He's riding his donkey, and the donkey has more spiritual discernment than the man upon his back. Where the donkey sees the angel and finally lays down because he can't go to the right, can't go to the left, can't go forward because the angel of the Lord is there and the donkey sees it and he won't go. He's already smashed Balaam's foot against the wall and Balaam got ticked and started smashing him. Now he lays down. And Balaam is so upset, he's ready to kill this donkey. And finally the donkey speaks to him and basically says, "What do you think you're doing?" And Balaam carries on a conversation with an ass. It's one of the more humorous things in the Bible. He's talking to his donkey. He is so mad, he doesn't even realize I'm talking to my beast and he's talking to me. And finally, God allows the donkey to see, Balaam, to see what the other donkey sees. And his eyes are opened. That's what's being referred to by Peter here. But he is warning us about the way of Balaam. Then Jude talks about the error of Balaam. Go to Jude 11. "Woe unto them, for they have gone in the way of Cain and ran greedily after the error of Balaam for reward and perished in the gainsaying of Kore." This is the error of Balaam. Then you get to Revelation chapter 2 and verse 14. "But I have a few things against thee, you church in Pergamos, because thou hast there them that hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed unto idols, and to commit fornication." So there you've got a very good sermon outline. Any of you who want to develop a sermon, you've got the way of Balaam, the error of Balaam, and the doctrine of Balaam, all listed in some of the last books of the New Testament, warning you, warning me about false prophets and false teaching. Balaam is not looked upon in a good way. So Balaam is seeking permission from God to curse Israel as King Balak requested. Back to Numbers chapter 22, verses 10 through 12. "And Balaam said unto God, Balak the son of Zippor, king of Moab, has sent unto me, saying, Behold, there is a people come out of Egypt, which covereth the face of the earth. Come now, curse me them. Peradventure I shall be able to overcome them and drive them out. And God said unto Balaam, Thou shalt not go with them. Thou shalt not curse this people, for they are blessed." God would not allow it. Three times, Balak requests a curse. Finally, when Balaam goes in disobedience to God, that's when the donkey falls beneath him and so forth. Finally, he gets there. And then, three times, King Balak requests a curse. And he thinks, if I just give Balaam a different perspective, if I take him maybe on this mountain and let him see this portion of the children of Israel, maybe now he'll curse them for me. And so King Balak thinks a different geographical view of God's people is going to help Balaam curse the people for him. But rather than Balaam seeing something that would give him reason to curse the people, he gets three different views of God's grace in the lives of God's people. And that's the title: How the World Views God's Grace in Your Life. How Balaam is now going to view God's grace right before his eyes. A people that he wants to curse in order to make money from Balak. And every time, instead of having a reason to curse the people, he has a reason to bless them. He sees God's grace. And I want to challenge us tonight that people would see God's grace in our lives. An imperfect people, we're not perfect. And yet there's something about us as being God's people that God can use for people to see. So let's look at how the world views God's grace in your life. First of all, we want to look at Numbers chapter 23. And here we're going to see a view of God's grace. But the first thing is God's saving grace in our lives. Balaam's view. Where does Balaam have his view? Balaam has his view. If you go back to chapter 24 and look at chapter 22, verse 41. "It came to pass on the morrow that Balak took Balaam and brought him into the high places of Baal, that thence he might see the utmost part of the people." So he is looking at a portion of the people. Balak thinks, okay, if I can bring Balaam over here and set him up and say, now, see these people out here. Let's say that this whole room is all of Israel. They can't see of all of Israel. So he says, I'm going to let you see the utmost part of them. I'm going to let you see a portion of them so that you can curse these people for me. So he takes them to the high places of Baal. And from there, Balaam sees the children of Israel. He sees right over here. He sees the hails right over here. Just this small portion of this entire congregation. He just sees them. And he sees them from the high places of Baal, a portion of the people. Then you see this ritual that he goes through. Look at verses 1 through 4 of chapter 23. And Balaam said unto Balak, build me here 7 altars and prepare me here 7 oxen and 7 rams. And Balak did as Balaam had spoken. And Balak and Balaam offered on every altar a bullock and a ram. And Balaam said unto Balak, stand by thy burnt offering, and I will go. Peradventure the Lord will come to meet me, and whatsoever he showeth me, I will tell thee. And he went to a high place, and God met Balaam and said unto him, I have prepared 7 altars, and I have offered upon every altar a bullock and a ram. So there's his ritual. Then you see Balaam's blessing. Here's what comes out of his mouth when he sees this little portion of the children of Israel. Look at verses 4 through 10. And God met Balaam, and he said unto him, I prepared 7 altars, and I have offered upon every altar a bullock and a ram. And the Lord put a word in Balaam's mouth and said, return unto Balak, and thus shalt thou speak. And he returned unto him, and lo, he stood by his burnt sacrifice, he and all the princes of Moab. And he took up his parable and said, Balak the king of Moab hath brought me from Aram out of the mountains of the east, saying, come, curse me, Jacob, and come, defy Israel. How shall I curse whom God hath not cursed? Or how shall I defy whom the Lord hath not defied? For from the top of the rocks I see him, and from the hills I behold him. Lo, the people shall dwell alone and shall not be reckoned among the nations. Note what he's saying here, folks. He is saying his very first prophecy reveals how he is impressed with God's people as the people dwell alone, or literally, these people dwell apart. This is a nation that shall not be reckoned among the nations, the last part of verse 9. Here is a people of God, and they're totally separate from all the other nations. Wow, what a nation. They're totally different. They're totally apart. These people are separate. These people are separated. They're unique. They're really something. This is from a false prophet. This is how the world is viewing God's saving grace. God brought them out of Egypt and set them. Here's this nation all by itself. What a testimony that these people have as they dwell alone. They're not even reckoned among the nations. Then notice his question in verse 10. Who can count the dust of Jacob? And the number, what's the name of this book? What's the name of this book? Ah, isn't that interesting? And the number of the fourth part of Israel. Let me die the death of the righteous and let my last end be like his. In other words, Balaam almost seems to wish that he was one of God's people. That's how impressed he is with this little portion that he's able to see. And instead of a curse coming out of his mouth, all he can do is bless. And it's almost like he wants to be part of God's people. Folks, that ought to be the wish of every unbeliever. When they see us, even a portion of us, they should desire to be numbered among us. Instead, sometimes we have Christians who are desiring to be numbered among them. How ironic. Balak would like to be numbered with the children of Israel. And this whole time, what does Israel want? We wish we could be like them. They want to be numbered with those, God's people sometimes, want to be numbered with those who look, act, dress, talk like the world. And we don't want to dwell alone. We don't want to dwell apart. And that's what impresses Balaam. Here is a nation of people all by themselves. They're separate. And look how great they are. Then you'll notice Balak's rebuke. Balak's ticked.
He was waiting for a curse, and here's Balaam blessing him. So look at verses 11 and 12 here, and you see his rebuke. Balak said unto Balaam, "What hast thou done unto me? I took thee to curse mine enemies, and behold, thou hast blessed them altogether." And he answered and said, "Must I not take heed to speak that which the Lord hath put in my mouth?" So there is a view of God's saving grace. Then we come to the second view that Balaam has, and it's a view of God's protecting grace that you'll see in the same chapter. And this time, Balaam has a view from the top of Pisgah. Look at verses 13 and 14. "And Balak said unto him, Come, I pray thee, and I'll take you to another place from whence thou mayest see them. Thou shalt see but the utmost part of them, and thou shalt not see them all. And curse me them from thence. And he brought him unto the field of Zophim to the top of Pisgah and built seven altars and offered a bullock and a ram on every altar." So it didn't work to have you to the top of Peor. Lay, come over here. Let me take you. Now look at them from here. So he changes the geographical location, and all that happens is Balaam gets another view of God's grace. And so now, instead of seeing this portion, he sees this other little portion of Israel from the Mount Pisgah. By the way, does Pisgah kind of ring a bell with you? In fact, I think there's a song about it. I've tried to recall the song. Does anybody remember what happened on the top of Mount Pisgah? It's also called Nebo. Bruce. Yes, yes. That's where Moses gets a view of the promised land. Carol. That's where it is. That's where it is. I was trying to think of that all week. Thank you. And so Moses is up there at the end of the book of Deuteronomy. He has this view, this wonderful view of the land that God has given to Moses. He goes, "Oh, I wish I could go." Same mountain that Balaam is taken to by Balak and said, "Now, look at him and curse him." And so there you see, Balaam goes through his ritual again, verses 14 and 15. Built seven altars, offered a bullock and a ram on every altar. Then he said to Balak, "Stand here by the burnt offering while I meet the Lord yonder." Then you see Balaam's blessing, verses 16 to 24. Note what is impressing him here. "And the Lord met Balaam," this is 23:16, "and put a word in his mouth and said, Go again unto Balak and say thus. And when he came to him, behold, he stood by his burnt offering and the princes of Moab with him. And Balak said unto him, What hath the Lord spoken? And he took up his parable and said, Rise up, Balak, and hear. Hearken unto me, thou son of Zippor. God is not a man that he should lie, neither the son of man that he should repent. Hath he said, and shall he not do it? Or hath he spoken, and shall he not make it good? Behold, I have received commandment to bless, and he hath blessed, and I cannot reverse it. He hath not beheld iniquity in Jacob." This is really something. You know the history of these people of Israel. And note what it says here. God has not beheld iniquity in Jacob, neither hath he seen perverseness in Israel. The Lord his God is with them, and the shout of a king is among them. God brought them out of Egypt. He hath, as it were, the strength of a unicorn. Surely there is no enchantment against Jacob, neither is there any divination against Israel. According to this time, it shall be said of Jacob and of Israel. Out loud, please. What hath God wrought? Exclamation point. This is what he is saying. The people, behold, the people shall rise up as a great lion and lift up himself as a young lion. He shall not lie down until he eat of the prey and drink of the blood of the slain. This is the second impression Balaam sees. He sees only the extreme end of them, and he's impressed by God's grace. And it's summarized in this. What hath God wrought? Who wrought this? Who did this? God did it. Folks, there's nothing in our lives that we can claim credit for. It's what has God wrought. Whatever God chooses to do through Bob Thomas is what God has done. Whatever God chooses to do through you is what God has done. What hath God wrought? And that's what impresses Balaam. That's his view of God's, it's his protecting grace, what God has done. By the way, you may remember that those, what is it, four words? Four words were telegraphed in American Morse code by Samuel F.B. Morse on May 24th, 1844, to officially open the Baltimore-Washington telegraph line. What hath God wrought? And that's what impresses Balaam. Then he's rebuked again, verses 25 and 26. And Balak said unto Balaam, neither curse them at all, nor bless them at all. But Balaam answered and said unto Balak, told not I thee, saying, all that the Lord speaketh, that I must do. And then we get to the third and the last view that Balaam has of God's people, God's grace in their lives. And this is God's transforming grace. Do you realize that God's grace transforms a believer? That God's grace changes a believer? That God's grace makes you a different creature. It makes you separate. It makes you different. It makes you peculiar. You are not the same person. God's grace transforms a believer. This time, Balaam's view is from the top of Peor. This is another mountaintop. Look at verses 27 and 28 of chapter 23. And Balak said unto Balaam, come, I pray thee, I will bring thee into another place. Peradventure, it will please God that thou mayest curse me them from thence. And Balak brought Balaam unto the top of Peor that looketh toward Jeshimon. And so from there you see this ritual take place again. Verses 29 and 30. Balaam said unto Balak, build me here 7 altars and prepare me here 7 bullocks and 7 rams. And Balak did as Balaam had said and offered a bullock and a ram on every altar. And then you've got Balaam's blessing in verses 2 through 9. And in verse 2, he describes what he sees. Look at verse 1. And when Balaam saw that it pleased the Lord to bless Israel, he went not as at other times to seek for enchantments, but he set his face toward the wilderness. And Balaam lifted up his eyes, and he saw Israel abiding in his tents according to their tribes, and the Spirit of God came upon him. He describes in verse 2 what he sees. What is it that he sees? He saw Israel encamped according to their tribes. Now, think about this. You are in the wilderness and you're looking at a people who are camped out in the wilderness. There are 2 to 3 million of them. What do you think it's going to look like? The typical people, what do you think it's going to look like? Well, this guy's just going to set up his tent wherever he can. In fact, he may find himself a little wadi. It's a little stream. And he sets up his tent by this little stream. And he says, this is where I'm going to camp. This other guy says, oh, I'm going to claim this part tonight because this is beside a tree. And when the sun comes up in the morning, I want to be in the shade. This guy says, well, I'm going to camp out here. And it's all in disarray. That's how a typical people would camp. Listen, when I go camping, I'm going to choose a spot. And I'm going to try to get there first. Because I want the best spot. On the contrary, how did Israel encamp? Israel encamped in such a way that it impressed Balaam. He saw Israel abiding in his tents. How? According to their tribes. We're going to see something here. What Balaam now says is prompted by the Spirit of God as he sees, listen to me, the orderliness of Israel's organization. He sees excellence. He sees beauty. Read about it. Let's read on. Verse 3, he took up this parable, his parable, and said, Balaam, the son of Beor, hath said, and the man whose eyes are open has said, he has said, which heard the words of God, which saw the vision of the Almighty, falling into a trance, but having his eyes open, how goodly are thy tents, O Jacob, and thy tabernacles, O Israel. He sees the beauty, the goodliness, and how organized, and how, wow, the excellence of these people. God uses order to impress and impact others, folks. That's what God uses. God uses a believer who excels as a believer. A believer who has a testimony of excellence in his life. Today, believers just think, well, you know what? Doesn't matter how I look, doesn't matter. You know, don't have to comb my hair if you have any. Don't have to comb it. Don't have to dress up. I just look like a slob like everybody else. And folks, God uses excellence to show orderliness to others. You go back to Numbers chapter 2. In fact, let's go back to Numbers chapter 2. Because he's impressed with how these tents are set up. You say, man, this is such a mundane thing. Yeah, you know, you see, it's the mundane things. It's the things that nobody else would ever think about. Where are you going to pitch your tent? That impresses people. Do you remember ever reading Numbers chapters 2 and 3? As you read this, this is really something. Now, before I preach this, in fact, I just did this about an hour ago, 2 hours ago. I went through my Bible and I took my color pencils and I highlighted these things in chapter 2. So this is something you can do that really helps you as you understand this. Look at verse 3 of chapter, let's look at verses 1 and 2 of chapter 2 of Numbers. And the Lord spake unto Moses and unto Aaron, saying, every man of the children of Israel shall pitch by his own standard. That's his own banner. With the ensign or the banner of their father's house, far off about the tabernacle of the congregation shall they pitch. So God is saying, you're going to pitch the way I want you to pitch. No man is going to do, men aren't going to do that which is right in their own eyes. You're going to do it the way I want it. That's what he's saying here. Notice the specifics. And on the east side toward the rising of the sun shall they of the standard of the camp of Judah pitch. Verse 5, Issachar is with him. Verse 7, Zebulun is with him. So on the east side you have Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. Go down to verse 9, the last sentence of verse 9. These shall first set forth. Oh man, everything is done in order. God does this in order. No, so there's the east side. Now go to verse 10. And now you've got the south side. On the south side shall be the standard of the camp of? It's Reuben now. Go to verse 12. With him is the tribe of? And go to verse 14, also the tribe of? So you got Reuben, Simeon, and Gad. Verse 16, last sentence of 16, they shall set forth in the second rank. Now, you've got a tribe in the center of the camp in verse 17. Then the tabernacle of the congregation shall set forth with the camp of the? Right there in the middle of the camp, as they encamp, so shall they set forward, every man in his place by their standard, by their banners. Verse 18, now you're going to the west side. The west side shall be standard of the camp of, who is it? And by him shall be the tribe of whom in verse 20? And then verse 22, what other tribe? And then in verse 24, the last sentence, they shall go forward in the third rank. Isn't this neat? God is doing everything in order. Everything has to be beautiful. Everything has to be done excellently. Okay, then you get to verse 25, and now you've got the north side of the camp. The standard of the camp of Dan shall be on the north side. They're going to be by their armies. Who's going to camp with him in verse 27? And in verse 29. So you've got all 12 tribes encamping around the center tribe, which is the tribe of Levi. And it says in the last part of verse 31, they shall go hindmost with their standards. Now, verse 34, and the children of Israel did according to all that the Lord commanded Moses. So they pitched by their standards, and so they set forward everyone after their families, according to the house of their fathers. Then you get to Numbers chapter 24, and Balaam looks down from the top of Mount Peor, and he says, he saw Israel abiding in his tents according to their tribes, and he says, how goodly are thy tents and thy tabernacles, O Israel. Why? Because they have been transformed by God. And in obedience to God, this is in obedience to God, that somebody on the outside observing them looks in and he says, wow, this is excellent. This is beautiful. What a reflection on God. What is Balaam used to seeing from the top of mountains? Well, here a tent, there a tent. It's almost, some song goes like that. Everybody's all spread out. Everybody's doing what they want to do. And folks, that almost describes churches today. Everybody doing what they want to do. Should not God's people, when they congregate, do so in an orderly way? Isn't that why Paul says, let everything be done decently and in order? Because God is a God of order. And God wants order because it is a testimony. Look up here and you'll see the arrangement of the camp. You can see how they would go forward. Now, the east is to the right, where Judah is, these three tribes. You've got the northern three, the western three, the southern three, and in the middle, you've got the tabernacle, and around that, you've got the Marites, Gershon, and the Kohathites. Moses and Aaron, when they set out, they go to the east. And these other tribes follow according to the order that God says. They take down the tabernacle, they begin to march. Here's another view of it, but now you've got the east going up this way, which would typically be north to us. Same thing, you've got the number of everyone who is armed for battle in each tribe numbered here. This is what Balaam saw from the top of Peor. He sees this orderliness. God's people are noticeable. God's people will establish order. When there is order, there's predictability. If you live in an orderly way, as a testimony to God's grace, God's transforming grace, you become predictable. There was a man who prayed in an orderly way. He prayed morning, afternoon, and evening, every day. And it was so predictable that the enemies of God used it against him. And we become so predictable that the enemies of God can almost use it against you. By the way, who was that man? Daniel. He was predictable. Orderliness means punctuality. Folks, things can't be done decently and in order if you come in 5 minutes late, you come in 10 minutes late. Oh, you know, when I get there, I'll get there. See, this is application. This is the part that you'd rather not hear, because this is where toes are stepped on. You know, choir's at 5 o'clock. Five after, somebody else walks in. Starts at 5. That doesn't mean you're in the parking lot at 5. You're here at 5. Church starts at 6. Well, see, people, all orderliness, that's no big deal. It doesn't matter when I get there. If everybody were to do church the way you do, what would this church be like? You try to get people to do things in order, but folks want to do things their own way. Everybody's an exception to take down the ropes or take down the reserve pew lines. Everybody's an exception to that. And they do their own thing. What happens when people do their own thing? You may as well be in the book of Judges and not the book of Numbers. Every man doing that which is right in his own eyes. A Christian fulfills his obligations. Well, then you see Balak rebuking him in verses 10 and 11, as he always did, but Balaam could do nothing else. I'm going to close with this. If God wanted order in his Old Testament people for the world to see, does he demand anything less of us in the New Testament? We are recipients of his grace just like they were. Some Christians have a wrong impression of God's grace in their lives. They think that God's grace in their lives gives them liberty to do what they want. It's just the opposite. God's grace in people's lives transforms them. And it is freedom to be what God made them to be. And a display of God's grace in the life of a believer will always be a reflection of the beauty, holiness, and order of God himself. And that's what we ought to strive for, to please God. Not for salvation, that's legalism. But as a testimony to God's grace, so that others may see it and others may fear, just like King Balak did. And as much as he tried to get Balaam to curse these people, couldn't be done. And as bad as these people were, it's just an amazing statement when you read that God says, I see no iniquity in them. Through Christ, he sees no iniquity in you. Positionally, I am sanctified. I am clean and pure through Christ. God's transforming grace, God's protecting grace, God's saving grace. That's what the world sees, should see in the life of a believer.